my background is I'm the youngest person to complete all 7 summits, including Mount Everest along the way, and currently ski mountaineering and free skiing just to fulfill my passion since I've been about 2 years old. And that's kind of my lifestyle is mountain and ocean living. Kilimanjaro was the first mountain that we had summited. And when we reached the summit, just shortly after I turned 10 years old, that was when I said, one down, 6 to go. Let's go ahead and finish off all the 7 summits. And, you know, 10-year-old me had no idea what 15-year-old me would be saying, but 15-year-old me definitely like looked back at 10-year-old me and thought like, what was I thinking at the time? Because, you know, and especially for my parents, I couldn't believe that they, you know, took me seriously, you know, when I approached them with this goal.
Make your life a dream and a dream a reality, says Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. Hi everyone, my name is Pierre-Arnaud Destremeau. I like to travel around the world in my spare time. I created the podcast Un bol d'air, which is the French expression of a bowl of fresh air, with the sole purpose of making you discover the hidden side of the lives of the greatest adventurers, travelers, and sportsmen of this world, to understand everything that shapes the public image that we have of them. The idea is very simple. Spend 1 hour of their time to share the craziest anecdotes with you and make you dream a little. Enjoy. Hello, everyone. Today, I'm welcoming Jordan Romero on the Un bol d'air. Welcome, Jordan, on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored that you reached out to me to do this, but I'm excited to share some stories.
Yeah, me too. For the ones who don't know you, can you introduce yourself, please?
Absolutely. My name is Jordan Romero. I'm 23 years old. I live in Salt Lake City, Utah. Currently during quarantine, I've been out in Hawaii for the past 5 weeks, recovering from a back injury from skiing. And now I'm currently in California at my mother's place, visiting family. But my background is I'm the youngest person to complete all 7 summits, including Mount Everest along the way, and currently ski mountaineering and free skiing just to fulfill my passion since I've been about 2 years old. And that's kind of my lifestyle is mountain and ocean living.
That's amazing. Can you tell me when it started? Like, what's day one for you? What's the first hike you've been doing?
So day one was it's a funny story. My journey started when I was about 9 years old, and I was on my way to my first day of school, and I noticed my school had done a complete redesign of the artwork around the buildings, and one of the murals that the school had painted and the art department was a mural of the 7 summits. And so it was just a very simple painting about like 2 meters tall, and it had like Mount Everest and all the other 7 summits on there. And so I was just so intrigued and fascinated by that every time I walked by, and I would study it very closely and memorize all the names and all the names, the elevations, the countries. And on my way home from school one day, after my father picked me up, I asked him what the 7 summits were. And he kind of looked at me a little puzzled. So my father's background was adventure racing all around the world through mountains and jungles. And it's a team sport, and it's a multi-sport and multi-discipline along the way. So one of the events that he did was Eco Challenge and Primal Quest back in the day. So he's endured a lot. And so the fact that I picked up a fascination with mountaineering was one of those disciplines that you do in adventure racing. So he was very excited to hear that I had a fascination with it. And then, with day one, it all kind of blended together within the first couple of weeks. But when I had gotten home, he wanted to bring me on a hike. And I remember suffering. It felt like I was suffering for the first like 5 minutes of the hike because I was just so, I wasn't out of shape, but I just, I feel like I was a little soft back then. And definitely needed some training to do, but that first hike definitely killed me at first. And I knew there was a lot of work to be done if I wanted to climb any of the mountains. And then later on, we just decided to go to Africa at some point, just because we already just traveled the world together as a family. And then we had the idea of, well, let's maybe go climb Kilimanjaro, still not with the idea of climbing the seven summits. And then we started climbing or training for Mount Kilimanjaro and doing all sorts of hikes and different methods of training, such as mountain biking and kayaking and cross training in the gym and just doing all sorts of activities to stay in shape. But we knew that Kilimanjaro was going to be less technical and a good mountain to start with. But that was kind of day one / first couple weeks of when I picked up the fascination.
And so just to make sure I understand that, so 9 years old, you start climbing, obviously with your parents or where your family is at least. Was your dad already into hiking? Was he already a fan of that?
Yeah. So my father was, my father was definitely into it. He took me under his wing, as a coach along with, my stepmother at the time, Karen Lundgren. So they both, had already done a lot of traveling around the world and, with adventure racing that they were doing at the time, it involved probably 10 to 12 different disciplines as far as like what you are somewhat good at. And hiking is definitely one of them because during a lot of their races, they would have to cross over some massive glaciers, sometimes in the Alps and sometimes in like British Columbia. And so they had traveled all around the world to do that. So they were somewhat familiar with ice axes and crampons and some of that. But it was cool because the style of my family has always been relatively minimalist. So especially with my father, the idea with those races is to pack very light and to move fast, basically. So with mountain climbing, we were able to instead of like big hiking boots, for example, on Kilimanjaro, we would just use like regular trail running shoes. And we were just making sure to pack light. And so as a result, I think, and just by simply listening to our bodies, we ended up climbing Kilimanjaro in about 3.5 days in comparison to usually a week or 2 weeks that it would take someone normally. So but we just listened to our bodies and we just moved based on our health and based on how we felt simply. So, but the three of us were very close together and we would always talk to each other. And we knew that if anything were to come up with how we felt, we would be able to, just communicate that very directly and just move quick.
So Kilimanjaro was the first one you actually went all the way up?
Yes, Kilimanjaro was the first mountain that we had summited. And when we reached the summit, just shortly after I turned 10 years old, so this was in, my birthday's in July 12th, and we summited July 22nd, I believe, in 2006. That was when I wanted to... That was when I said one down, six to go. Let's go ahead and finish off all the seven summits. And 10-year-old me had no idea what 15-year-old me would be saying. But 15-year-old me definitely like looked back at 10-year-old me and thought like, what was I thinking at the time? Because, you know, and especially for my parents, I couldn't believe that they, you know, took me seriously, you know, when I approached them with this goal. Because, you know, I look at most 10-year-olds today and usually they're just, they're pretty, I don't know how to describe, I couldn't take them seriously if they wanted to, like climb any of the seven summits really. But I really, really appreciate that they at least did that. So
if 10 years old Jordan is on all the way up at the Kilimanjaro, what are you thinking there? Like, do you remember what you thought actually when you were there? Do you remember your first, I don't know?
Yeah, I briefly do. You know, a lot of my memories are kind of laid out in my book, No Summit Out of Sight. And off the top of my head, you know, my memory is kind of faded from there. I can definitely give you a good outline of the trip, but for the most part, like all the details and how I felt, it might be a little bit off, but you know, I think stepping up to my first big mountain was overwhelming and definitely a little scary, because I just knew it was like, it felt like to me like a football athlete going to like their first big game or their first, you know, you definitely feel it's a game time type of feeling when you're, you know, approaching the trailhead, especially with Mount Kilimanjaro. And I just thought to myself, like, well, this is what all the training and everything has prepared me for. So it was a little nerve-wracking to not only prove to my parents and not only to myself, but to like prove to like also the Sherpas, you know, I knew I had to maintain my maturity, especially along the whole way up, because, you know, with my parents and with myself, I have a lot of emotions, you know, especially when, you know, as I'm climbing, because, you know, it's when you're that young, you just don't know, how to suffer. I think you don't know how to understand that any sort of like, you know, discomfort is only temporary, because it'll seem like forever when you're in the moment. So that took a while to actually understand the whole mind over matter thing. So being young definitely was a little tough in that aspect for sure. But that I definitely remember clearly.
How do you train? How does 10 years old Jordan train for that kind of a hiking?
So 10-year-old Jordan would be, as far as training, the training for Mount Kilimanjaro was not as intense as like Mount Everest or Denali for that matter too, which were some of the harder mountains. I think that, you know, when I first got into training, it just seemed like overwhelming for me at first, and it just was something I didn't really enjoy at first. But so it took a while to actually like it, but I knew that it took a while for me to understand that every day I'm stronger than I was the day before. And we made sure to get in a consistent rhythm every day, you know, especially when I got home from school. And so in order to train, I would do where my house was, it's about a 100 meter walk up the road, and then you have just endless trails for mountain biking and hiking and trail running. So those were the top three like more accessible ways of training that I would do. As far as like shoulder strength, we would do a lot of kayaking. And so my parents, my father and Karen, they had a lot of gear from adventure racing already. So we were able to like use those kayaks. We were able to use like those stand up paddle boards. We were able to do some of those water sports, and like I had a mountain bike to use, and so did they, and we also had like bicycles for road racing, kind of like as you see in La Tour de France. So we would do that. We made sure to always mix it up, because, you know, training after a while can get very can get very stale, especially if you like only go to the gym. So to train outside and to, you know, train at high altitude was very beneficial too, because Big Bear is at about 2,500 meters in elevation. So it was very beneficial for high altitude training as well. So, but for mountains like Everest and for mountains like Mount Aconcagua in South America, I would be, using like a hypoxic tent, a few weeks before in order to, grow more red blood cells and to learn how to adapt and sleep at higher altitudes.
Okay. And so if at 10 years old, you're already above 6,000 meters, I don't even know, like, do you actually say meters or do you measure them in feet? How do you function in the US?
We measure them in feet, but in meters, it's a little tougher to translate. I just know, like, based on, I know like 8,000 meters off the top of my head, and I know like the elevation of Big Bear, but it's everything in between. I have a tough time like matching in my head, but yeah, but okay. I do my best.
I'll do my best as well.
I try to balance both. I want to be fluent in the metric system as well, because I know that for some reason the US doesn't do that, and so I try to make it so other people can understand.
Makes sense. So when do you decide to continue the list of the seven? Like, was Kilimanjaro the first of the list, or when did you actually decide when you were up there to do the six next?
I decided when I was up there at the summit to continue climbing all the seven summits.
And so every time you do it with your parents, like, did you climb the seven with your parents, or?
Yes, it was my father and my stepmother at the time, Karen. So it was the three of us that climbed all seven summits together, as a family and as a team.
That's a big team. So when do you start training for the next one? Like, is it on your way back from Kilimanjaro, or did you wait a year before you started doing?
No, we started training like right as I got back. So that was in July 2006, and then we didn't go to Australia until like April 2007. So that was when we, so that was the next mountain. And so even just in between Kilimanjaro and Kosciuszko, you know, Kosciuszko was not that big of a climb. I think it was roughly about like 2,500 meters as well. So it's roughly the same elevation as Big Bear, where I grew up. So, but at the same time, it wasn't necessarily like training for the mountains. It was just getting my body conditioned to be able to handle just climbing in general. So we just incorporated training into like my lifestyle. And so I did it for not only climbing the mountains, but to get my body in top health and top strength and everything else. So, there were certain ways of exercising that we would use to prepare for each mountain. Like for Denali, for example, for the first half of the climb, we would be towing sleds, which had a lot of our gear because a lot of it was self-supported. And, so in order to train for that, I would come home from school and put on like a heavy backpack, and we lived on a dirt road. So I would drag a car tire or a truck tire up and down the road, with a rope and a harness, to get my hips, strengthened, in order to do that. So there were different ways, but for the most part, our training regimen was relatively the same. It was always outside, and it was always like a way to mix it up because we didn't want to get bored after a while.
And how do you deal with school at the time? Like, where do you get the time to do that while you're actually still going to school?
So with school, it was interesting, and it was able to work out actually very well because I had like a modified year-round schedule with my school. So I would, for example, have like 2 weeks off in the fall, 3 weeks off in the winter, 2 weeks in spring, and then 6 weeks during the summer. So up until Mount Everest, which was number six of the seven, we were able to fit each of these expeditions within all the breaks basically around the year. So mostly during summer and winter break. And then Everest, I actually had to go on an independent study, like homeschool, because that mountain you can only go between April and May during that year. So that took up a big chunk of my semester for my spring semester at school. So I was able to bring up like some textbooks for that mountain, and I was literally doing homework at base camp and advanced base camp. So I just had like a big list of assignments and material to read in order to pass eighth grade.
That's awesome. So yeah. So just to make sure I understand that, you did an average about two summits per year, more or less?
I would average...
You started 10 years old, right?
Yeah, so I started at 10 years old and finished when I was 15. I was actually... So I couldn't tell you how many I averaged a year. I'd probably say like 1.5 or 2. So Kilimanjaro was like in 2006. And then we did Mount Kosciuszko, Mount Elbrus in Russia, and Mount Aconcagua in Argentina, all three in the year of 2007. And then in 2008, we did Mount Denali in Alaska in June. So that was only only one mountain during that year. And then in 2007. And then 2008, we did Denali. And then in 2009, just after I turned 13, was when we did Mount Karstens Pyramid. And then 2010 was when we did Everest. And then at the very end in December, like Christmas Day of 2011, was when we did Mount Vincent in Antarctica. So it was the year of 2007 when we did three mountains that really put us ahead of schedule, because before then we planned to do only like one a year. And then, yeah, that year of 2007 when I was 10 and 11 was... just really got us ahead of schedule. So that's why Everest came up, and I was 13, and we said, well, I guess we should start preparing for this one now, because we didn't intend to do Mount Everest before Antarctica, because Antarctica just brought about a lot of challenges logistically to go there, because I was too young to even step foot on the continent. So that's why we saved Antarctica for last.
Oh, because there's an age limit to go there?
There was at the time. I don't know if it still is now. I think it was 16. And when I was 15 and a half was when I was granted like special permission. So we definitely had to pull some strings through some connections that we had in order to make it happen. But but that was why we saved that one for last, because we tried to go the winter before Everest, and it just didn't work out. And then we tried going the winter after Everest, and it still didn't work out. So then in 2011, it was finally able to happen.
And so there's a limit age to go to Antarctica, but there's no limit age to go up to Everest.
Well, there was actually. So there is now on Everest. It was there was an age limit for, I want to say it was 16 at the time for the Nepalese side, because Everest is on the border of China and Nepal. In China, there was no age limit at the time. And then as soon as I left Everest, they set the age limit to to no one under 18 can climb on the China side. And then when I was a sophomore and then my second year of university, I remember reading that they set the age limit to 18 as well on the Nepal side. So, but after I had finished this girl, I forget what her name was, but there was a girl who became the youngest woman to climb Mount Everest, and she was 1 month older than me when she had summited. So yeah, it was crazy. I thought for sure she would become the youngest, but hearing that she was 1 month younger, I was like, okay, cool. Like, I mean, at this point, I don't really care anymore, but I was like, oh damn. Like oh, someone's going to break my record.
So the record, just to make sure I understand that, is 13 years old all the way up.
Yeah, so I was 13 years old, 13 years and 10 months old, and she was 13 years and 11 months old, if I remember correctly. So, yeah. Wow. I was 2 months from turning 14 years old.
And so if I'm not mistaken, that record is not to be broken until the legislation changes.
Yes, yes. Yeah, if I remember correctly, the record still holds before the legislation changed, but I mean, I'm sure somebody somewhere is going to find a loophole of some sort in order to do it. So I wouldn't be surprised if they did let someone younger than me climb it, but I don't know. I mean, I heard a while ago that a 12-year-old was going to try to do it, but I don't think that they were even close to letting him up, just because he was trying to climb from, I forget which side, if it was the China or Nepal side, but it's a lot harder nowadays to go at a younger age than 18, but it's still possible. I'm sure there will be some way that some kid who is younger will be able to sneak up or something. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
But like, maybe the Sherpas kids, no?
Yeah, if anything, it would probably be a Sherpa.
Do you think all the Sherpa that are helping you get all the gear up have made it to the top?
Yeah. So when I was within our team, we had six people in total that were aiming for the summit, and there were just a few people who stayed at base camp and helped manage that and all the cooking. But past advanced base camp, it was only six of us that had gone up. So we had three Sherpa guides who we formed a very tight bond with. They were the most humble and some of the strongest people that we had come across so far. And they were just incredibly, incredibly nice. We decided to, instead of going with a Western company, we decided to go with a Sherpa owned and operated guiding operation. They were a little less expensive, but we knew that we wanted to, that, you know, that we knew that our money would be able to support them and their families directly. So that's why we decided to go with them, and their experience was a lot more than most other Western climbers or any European or North American climbers. So they were awesome to get to know. It was amazing for me at 13, especially. I mean, I had traveled the world a lot, but it was really cool to really get to know them and understand their culture more, and how climbing Everest has become such an economic resource for them and their families. So that was cool to get to know. But since then, I've learned a lot more about how Everest has become that for just the Sherpa community in general. It's been kind of a double-edged sword, because for once, they, especially on the Nepal side, you know, the trek from the airport that you fly into to get to the base camp of Mount Everest is all the communities along that route have grown so much because of Everest tourism, which has been great, because a lot of those communities actually have a secondary school education, and you know, it's done a lot for them positively. However, a lot of those families do feel they worry a lot, because, you know, every year they just know that, you know, like their husband or their son who's helping carry the gear or guide people up may not come back because of an incident from Everest. So, like I said, it's a double-edged sword, and there's, you know, it's not perfect by any means. And there's a documentary that will explain very well. It's called Sherpa. If you look up the trailer for it, or decide to rent the movie, it's really, really good. It does a really good job of explaining, you know, how Everest has economically, benefited the Sherpa communities. But then it also shows like the most, recent incidents that happened when 14 Sherpas died in an avalanche, I think it was the year of 2014. When that happened, and there was just a big like conflict in base camp because in their culture they have to do a proper burial in order to reincarnate. So there was a lot of conflict happening at base camp following that incident.
Yeah, I can imagine. Can we have a quick pause about the economic part that we just talked about, that just to make sure I understand how did you guys fund all the mountains? Because like I think the Everest is quite expensive compared to the six others, but still I'm guessing Antarctica is not too cheap either. So how did you get the money?
Yeah, so most of the climbs up until Everest were for the most part as far as finances go, most of the climbs were funded through simply like selling t-shirts and donations and some of our own funds, because up until Everest the climbs were relatively within reach financially for us. So luckily we had a lot of we had a lot of sponsors that were able to toss us some free gear and some grants from time to time. And then Everest was a whole nother beast, as far as, finances go. And that's when we, you know, other than like simply selling t-shirts and like partnering with local restaurants to do fundraisers, we had to apply for grants, with sponsors and reach out to them for proposals. And, we pulled some strings from like friends of friends who were able to help donate and loan money for the climbs. So all in all, like before Everest, we only had like a one-way ticket to Nepal. And so it was a very, it was kind of worrisome for us from what I remember. Like even, you know, we had our last bit of like actual cash that we had on hand was to give to the yak herdsman to be able to carry most of our gear up to up to advanced base camp, which was kind of worrisome. And then after that, it was just it was mostly credit cards that we had used in order to get back, which was definitely put the family in a bit of a hole. But as far as how to, and it was pretty much the same thing with Antarctica. So as far as recovering from that, book sales do help with from No Summit Out of Sight, and to be able to travel around and speak to different schools and share my story also help with that as well. But it wasn't easy for sure. And you know, with for us, I mean, we're a middle class or working class family, so it was definitely not as simple as writing a check. But thankfully, to the community of Big Bear Lake in Southern California, and the sponsors that we had, and some of our and some friends that were able to help make it happen, it's an immense amount of gratitude that I always extend to for helping make that dream come true. And yeah, it was that itself is a whole nother story. When I was 13 years old, I feel like I was definitely too young to kind of like fully understand, I think, everything that was going on from that end. So that's definitely a question for my father and Karen as well. But it was not easy to pull together. And like I said, we've always been kind of minimalist. So as far as like all the gear and everything we took, we relied on mostly what we needed. And so we didn't really have like as much, you know, like luxury items that a lot of the other bigger teams with the bigger money usually have.
Okay. And the can we talk 2 seconds about the coach or the person that trained you? Was it directly your father or like was it okay, so he knew enough to train you all the way through?
Yeah, it was Karen and my father that had coached me, and they as far as like nutrition, physical training, everything, that was totally up to them. So I would come home from school and they say, all right, Jordan, we're gonna go do this, and I'd be like, okay, sounds good. So that's how it started.
They're both pretty fit now, no? They're like, are they maybe physical trainers or in their daily job or how?
Yeah, so as of right now, my father owns and operates a gym out in Hawaii, in Maui, and Karen herself, she is a ski race coach. So she is in Mount Hood, Oregon, doing that. So they've always been very, very fit people. They both are really into they're both really into CrossFit. So that is kind of what my training consisted of, especially right before Everest, in order to really build strength and muscle, was doing CrossFit, cross training, and kind of just, you know, a lot of like mobility based exercises too. So they've always been, you know, very knowledgeable about health and wellness and nutrition.
Okay. Can you describe if you're 13 and a half, so like it's a few months before you actually go to mount the Everest, what's a typical week like? What does Thursday look like?
Thursday? Well, considering that I'm doing homeschool most likely, especially during those weeks and months leading up to Everest, it was very to remember a daily routine. That's kind of funny. That's the funny thing too, is like there was not really a routine as much because we mixed it up like all day every day. But as far as my diet goes, my diet was very calorie dense because I knew I would have to like pack on some calories, especially before Everest, because people tend to lose a lot of weight, especially on those trips. So it would start out with a big breakfast, and too, you know, me being 13 years old, you know, I'm beginning that stages of becoming a bottomless pit with as far as eating goes. Between 13 and 18, I was just constantly hungry no matter what. It was insane. And so it would start out with a huge breakfast, and then shortly after that go train for at least a couple of hours. Usually we would do gym training at night, or sorry, gym training would be mostly like mid morning, and then lunch in the middle, and then some sort of training, usually whether it was like skiing, snowshoeing, or whatever it might be. As far as like outdoor training, that would mostly be in like the afternoon, and then after that would be going through more gear and kind of laying it all out like in the living room of our house, because the weeks leading up to Everest were, you know, we had to get that packing list super dialed in, and we had to make sure that we, you know, checked off the boxes of every single gear item on the list. And so we would do that mostly in the evening time, and just work on some emails to logistically prepare for the climb, and then get a big night's sleep, usually in the hypoxic tent that I was sleeping in my room to prepare me for the altitude, and repeat the next day. Oh, and also do a little bit of homework as well for probably about an hour or two before I go to bed. So that's like a rough idea. I mean, it's not exact, but that was what it mostly consisted of.
And for Antarctica was the same thing. Like the training for the last mount in Antarctica was also that harsh.
Yes, training for Antarctica was not as intense from what I remember, because the mountain is at a lower elevation, and for the most part, I was just skiing like I normally would in order to prepare for that one. When I was like skiing at home, I had to like make a conscious effort, especially like not to do anything stupid or anything to like hurt myself, because that would be really bad to like break my leg before an expedition and then you have to cancel it all. And oh my God, that would have been bad, but thankfully that didn't happen. So before Antarctica, yeah, it consisted of a lot of basic training. I don't think it was as intense as Everest, but I feel like at that point, my physical fitness was mostly like maintenance based. So I just had to do like a little bit pretty much every day, before a mountain like that. But, Mount Vinson in Antarctica was a good mountain to end everything with, because it was so, I don't want to say relaxed, but it was just like I was able to, we were able to ski while we were down in Antarctica during some of the down days. So we were in Antarctica for about 10 or 11 days, and Mount Vinson took about 4 or 5 days. So we had some extra time to go climb and ski some other nearby mountains. We didn't ski from the summit of Mount Vinson, but that was just an activity that we did to kind of keep ourselves entertained and keep ourselves like kind of fit, because we always made sure that like even during those down days, you don't want to be like laying in the tent or staying in the dining room tent like all the time. You want to be like out and moving, and you want to keep your yourself from going crazy during those days.
So you obviously didn't break anything or didn't harm yourself before you actually went up of any of these seven mountains, but did you have any accidents or any injuries during these climbs?
So as far as climbing all the mountains go, I was lucky to walk away injury free from all of them. However, there was one incident on Mount Everest in which we had come across an avalanche in about like midway up between advanced base camp and camp one. So this happened at roughly about 21,000 feet, which is
7,000. Yeah, more or less.
Yeah. Sorry, 21,000 feet in meters. So yeah, so this avalanche happened at roughly, 6,400 meters in elevation. And it was a absolutely terrifying thing that happened, because we were traversing across, a glacier. And when we come across these like ice shelves, like these seracs, my father had kind of an instinct within him that just told the rest of the team, like, we got to get moving a little bit faster in order to get out of this zone and get to a safe spot as quickly as possible. And we said okay, and it was a hot day that day. It I don't know what the temperatures got up to, but I was like down to my base layers. We were hearing like some cracks and some booms in the ice, so we knew we had to kind of get in and out of that zone as quickly as possible. And not 2 minutes after he had said that, this avalanche had this ice shelf that we were looking at completely collapsed and turned into a small avalanche that definitely not even a small avalanche. It was huge and absolutely terrifying. I didn't know what to think, because we were kind of on the edge of the slide path itself. So it brought myself, my dad, and one of our other Sherpas, Karma Sherpa, what was his name, down with us. Everyone else was further up ahead, and Karen was actually recording this on her on the camcorder or the video camera that we had brought with us. So after the dust had settled, we were drugged down probably like not even like probably about like 100 meters or so. Probably a little less than that. But when the dust had settled, I was buried up to my waist. And my father was right behind me, and the crampons at the base of my, at the bottom of my boots had, punctured both of his thighs, punctured both of his legs and one in his forehead, which I felt incredibly bad about doing. So he was behind me when that had happened, and we were just so focused on getting up to safety at the moment. But later on, I noticed there was like a red mark in his toque, basically, that he was wearing. And, that's when I noticed. I apologized to him like a million times. I was like, I'm so sorry that this happened. He said, it's okay. Like, but we had to get a medical attention, later that day. When we returned back to Advanced Base Camp, one of our neighboring teams that we were camping like next to had a medical doctor on staff. And normally my dad kind of took that role because he had some experience in EMT and life flight medics. And so he started we had another medic from another team take care of him and stitch him up, which was pretty bad to see as well. I felt incredibly bad during that whole process, and so I was glad he was okay and he was able to pull through, but he was tough as nails to be able to endure that.
And his thighs were okay to walk afterwards?
Yeah. No legs broken, fortunately, but yeah, he would definitely. He definitely was in some pain for I'd say like a week after that, but then the rest of the time he was doing completely fine. We always made sure to check in with him a little bit extra, so he was doing okay as far as I know. He's not good at letting people know about like how he's feeling. Like if he's in pain, he like will try, and that's kind of how I am too, or a lot of people are. It's just like, you know, you'll feel pain and then people will ask you, oh, how are you doing? And you're like, I'm good. Like, I don't feel anything. So you're, I don't know, sometimes, but it's good. I mean, we were close enough together to where we could actually like say, man, I'm in pain. Like something isn't feeling good. And I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's a balance of trying to work through any pain that you have, but also being transparent with other people and saying like, guys, I'm in a lot of pain. It's that like things are not feeling right, because you don't want to be like ignoring big things that could be damaging to your health.
Can you remind us what's the process to go up all the way? Like what's step one, step two, step three, camp one, camp two, camp three? How does it go and how long does it take?
So the process for Mount Everest is you drive from Kathmandu to the Chinese base camp, and then from base camp you go to intermediate base camp and then advanced base camp, and then past that it's camp one and then camp two, and then there's a camp three up there as well, which we didn't really spend the night in, but that's all in all there's about six camps along the way.
Okay, and so how long did it take between you being in Kathmandu all the way up to the Mount Everest?
From the time we got to Kathmandu and then up to Everest, so we spent about like 5 or 6 days in Kathmandu, and then driving to base camp alone took about 6 days from what I remember. So it was about, yeah, a little over 7 weeks from base camp to the summit of Everest. And then it took about 1 week from the summit of Everest it took about 5 days to get from the summit of Everest back to Kathmandu, and then we spent about 2 or 3 more days in Kathmandu, and then we finally set flight back to back home, basically.
That's amazing. So out of the 2 months, you spent 7 weeks going up, 1 week going down.
Yes. Yeah, so pretty much. The reason why it takes so long to climb up is because you have to acclimatize to the high altitude. And so that's just something you really want to take your time with, especially, you know, being as you're entering, you know, in the 7,000 meter plus area, that's when you have to start moving a little bit slower. But as far as coming back down, like, you could go from the summit of Everest back to sea level right away and your body's going to like feel really good. Whereas if you were to go from sea level to the summit of Everest, your body would not know what to do. And it would just be so overwhelmed with high altitude. So, yeah, that was really, that was cool in a sense, just kind of learning how the body, is able to adapt in colder temperatures and higher altitude as well. And so, it was cool to gain some knowledge in that area as well. Just learning what the body does, as you're climbing up and down.
I'm guessing the feeling is similar when you go up on the Aconcagua and other where you're actually dominating the rest of the valley. At the moment I'm speaking to you, I have Mont Blanc right there, so like
1
kilometer and a half. Yeah, I'm in the mountains.
No way. So you're in the Chamonix area.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Only like 1,300 high meters, so it's about 3,000 feet high. So it's not that high, but we have the Mont Blanc in our sight right over there, so it's pretty
fun. Yeah. What's the what's the name of the town you're in?
It's called Saint-Gervais.
Saint-Gervais,
Gervais.
Okay. Saint-Gervais. Oh, okay. Interesting. I had a roommate when I was out in Hawaii. She was from that area as well. I forget the exact town that she is from, but she was from that area. She was like closer to Mont Blanc as well, but I forget exactly which community she was from. But that's awesome. France is high on my list for sure to come visit. I actually was going to be, I was supposed to be right now before coronavirus cracked down. I was supposed to be in the Swiss Alps or in the French Alps actually right about now. My friend and I were going to do some skiing in Switzerland and the French Alps. And then we were going to go up to Sweden after that. But aside from Mount Elbrus in Russia, I've never really been like in Europe. That's like an area I've never really like traveled around. So I've never been to like France, Germany, France, Germany, Spain, Austria, Switzerland, Italy. Like those are some of the most like beautiful world destinations that I still have never been to, but the mountains there look absolutely incredible. It's like the European Alps and New Zealand that are high on my list to go to, because the mountains are just so like incredibly vast and beautiful. And it's just really cool when like mountains, especially in like British Columbia or New Zealand, go straight into the ocean, because those are my two favorite places, just like the ocean and the mountains. And you know, both have played a very big part of my life growing up. So it's high on my list. I really hope to be in France as soon as all this calms down.
Well, it's a good thing that you climbed the Mount Everest at 13 years old. It gives you a lot of time to do the rest of your life.
Yeah, exactly. And not necessarily that I'd love to do it again someday, but at the same time, like there's so many mountains like in the world that I still have never been to, and some that are unclimbed that I would like to do someday. But at the moment, I guess this everything that's going on in the world right now gives you some time to really plan and figure out what you're gonna do after everything settles down. What's the situation like in France right now? Are you guys slowly recovering at this point?
we are, and it's supposed to be deconfining, like they say, the May 11th. So it should be going on from there. So in a few few weeks it should be okay to start over, say real life, and see how it goes. But it's probably going to be progressive. So it's going to be a few areas first, and then the next ones, and then I'll probably won't be able to go back to Paris, where I actually live, all year, until maybe end of May, because they won't allow us to go through the different regions in France. So we'll see.
Right.
Yeah, I'm confident, but we'll have to be patient.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like it's a lot easier for everyone to stop what they're doing, especially in your area. Like people in the U.S. are very have been not happy, like, at all. They've I don't know. I mean, the U.S. has never really experienced anything like this in recent history. So it's just because of like the whole culture and of individual freedom and all that stuff that makes people just all like, who's to tell me that that I can't go to work? Who, like, they just think it's like illegal constitutionally to have people like do this right now. And it's like, okay, it's a pandemic going on right now. Like, obviously you kind of have to, it's a state of emergency we're going into. So like there were protests last, like about a week ago on Sunday, like all around the country to so that people can go back to work. It's like, you guys are gathering in mass groups at this point. You're just making it worse at this point. So, I mean, it's understandable because the U.S. just had no platform to take care of the people, you know, when they lose their jobs or you know, like there's no paid sick leave here, mandatory. Whereas in France and most European countries, there is, at least. So that's why it's been a lot harder to, like, you don't get money if you don't work, essentially. And there are unemployment resources, but it's so overwhelmed right now because they've never seen this many people apply for unemployment, like, right off the bat. So even to this day, like, the small businesses and people that applied for unemployment still haven't seen any money. So that's why people are starting to get very restless and frustrated, which is completely understandable.
Completely. So before I started talking about Melbourne, my question was, I'm guessing the feeling must be the same when you're all the way up to from Aconcagua or any other mount in the world, to have like this overview of the horizon and the whole valley or just the rest of the land across. But how does it feel to be on the highest one, like on top of the world in the Everest? What do you feel there?
the feeling on the summit of Everest was unbelievable. It was very euphoric for sure, because it almost didn't feel real. Like, it almost felt like a dream. So to stand up there was it didn't feel real. And it was just weird, because I never thought in my life that standing on the summit of Mount Everest would ever be possible. And it was just surreal, being up there and looking over the horizon was absolutely incredible. It's crazy because you just have like, you try to envision the summit of Everest for a long time, especially like just through movies and other films, and to actually be up there, it's like, you know, you just can't believe you're like in that, you're just in that movie scene, or you're in that area that is just so sought after. And the craziest thing is just when you're down at base camp, you know, you're also surrounded by other absolutely massive Himalayan mountains too. So when you're actually up there at the summit and you're overlooking all of them, that's when you're just like, you're also surrounded by giants too, like other Himalayan mountains as well. So it's surreal to kind of be overlooking them. And you also see some of the other 8,000 meter peaks, such as like like Makalu and Lhotse and Choyu and a few others that you can see out in the distance as well. But that was like the coolest thing as well, to see the other 8,000 meter peaks that surround Mount Everest.
It must be amazing. Jordan, do you live of that, or like, what's your job today? How do you continue hiking and working?
I'm in kind of a funny zone right now. So, or a funny time of my life right now. I've been unemployed for about, it's April 24th. So I've been unemployed for just a little over, three or four months now. I worked a lot over the past year. I was, landscaping, and doing construction and serving tables at a local restaurant in Salt Lake City. So that's what I did in order to, I was saving up for a car at first, and then like mid-January, I just knew I had enough money that I could, be unemployed and pretty much, ski every day, which is exactly what I did. And then I went out to the East Coast of the United States for a park shoot. So basically we were flown out by a beer company, out in Vermont. And, so we were doing like a week long, skiing event, like a video and photo shoot. And then, I took a very big slam and unfortunately fractured, three vertebrae on my back. So, that's pretty much my first injury ever. I'm 23 and I hadn't broken a bone until then. So it wasn't that bad. I went and got a CT scan, and they said I didn't need a back brace nor surgery. So that was very good. But I was in a lot of pain that first week. Now it's been about 7 weeks since then, as of yesterday, and my body is definitely feeling a lot better. I can do a lot of yoga and a lot of all that like body weight exercises, and so my back's feeling a lot better. But I was just in Hawaii for the past 5 weeks, because that's where my father lives now. And so I was kind of taking advantage of the warm climate to be able to heal myself. And I'm currently in Southern California visiting my mother and still continuing the healing process. So, I'll start to work again, hopefully within the next few weeks. But as far as injuries go, I definitely couldn't have timed it any better, because like a week after I hurt my back was when the US pretty much went on full lockdown from COVID-19. And so all the ski resorts here and in Europe, like all closed at like the same weekend as well. So I don't have any like fear of missing out because of that as well. So it's kind of nice in that regard. But now I know I can't really landscape for the rest of the summer, especially with my back. So I'm going to have to find some other way to make money at this point. So, but I'm confident. I mean, I'm just, kind of trying to get everything all sorted out and hopefully, take some advantage of like the economy, being in the state that it is now, and start to make some money from that as well. So that's kind of where I'm at right now, with my body and job wise. So I know it's a new, I know that was a long story, but it was kind of a funny situation as far as like what's been going on in the world and where I'm at right now. So sure, that's kind of the update lately.
Jordan, with someone who's been already on the Mount of Everest, 13 years old, how do you like, what's your dream today? Like, what can be bigger dream than that one?
I think a bigger dream than climbing Mount Everest is just simply pursuing a happy and healthy life at this point. It's actually next month will be 10 years since we summited Everest, which is crazy to think about. But yes, as far as, as far as like a bigger dream, it's kind of tough to say. A lot of my, especially since I was 13, a lot has changed in my life and my interests since then. I've pursued skiing a lot more heavily, and so that's what I've been focusing on for the past like 5 or 6 years since I moved out to Utah, because it's the skiing is just a lot better there, and I was hoping to, like I said, come to Europe as well before my back broke and all of this started happening, to continue skiing more. So not competitively, but just for filming and recreationally. And it's just something that I just enjoy doing. So I think like a bigger project than climbing Everest is just like living each day to the fullest and just continuing making big things happen, whether it involves you know, climbing and skiing other mountains or producing like a film segment or something like that. But it's nice. I mean, I'm just kind of at a fork in the road right now in life, and I don't know, after spending some time out in Hawaii, it's definitely up there on a list as far as a place I'd like to move to. I've always loved the tropics, and getting into water sports is just such a new area to like master, like as far as like surfing or anything. Like I didn't really grow up doing that, so just to like start from scratch and learn how to and become a beginner in something new is definitely a fascinating process. So that's kind of where I'm at as far as like what else can be done to top Everest. And it's tough. I mean, now these days, I mean, I don't really like have any sponsors at this point. So it's just kind of like starting from scratch as far as like getting gear together and making the connections happen. So that's sort of where I'm at. I know it wasn't a very clear explanation, but that's pretty much where I'm at right now.
That's perfectly fine. And how do you see the rest of your life hiking wise? Like do you think you'll take your children once hiking as well? How do you pursue that?
Yeah, I think one of these days it's just I think like, well, yeah, right now my priority is I think like within the next, I don't know how long. I mean, I definitely want to would hope to buy a house at some point and kind of get life a little bit more settled. I don't have a wife and kids yet, so I'm just currently enjoying that for as long as it goes. And I mean, if I were to have kids one day, I would most definitely get them into hiking and skiing and get them into what I enjoyed doing growing up. So that I could definitely see myself doing that. And if one of them wants to climb Mount Everest, I mean, I would take them as seriously as my parents did with me. So I would do my best to help make that dream come true. So,
like, do you think hiking for you is has become like a drug? Like, does it look like a drug for you? Is giving the best of you every time something that you're addicted to?
I wouldn't say I'm addicted to it. I just find it as a place of like tranquility almost. Like when I'm skiing and hiking, I find myself just in a more like meditative state of mind. It's a place that I can kind of like shut off the rest of the world almost and just kind of focus on my own thoughts and everything that I'm in right now, because it's just important, especially when you're skiing and when you're climbing and you're in those more intense moments, is to be very present in the situation that you're in and to focus on what you're doing at the moment. So it gives you a time to just learn how to be and to live in the moment. You know what I mean? So it's pretty, it's meditative for me, if anything. So it's not really addictive. I just find a lot of, like I said, peace and tranquility when I'm doing it. It just gives me a mind, a time to clear my head from everything else going on in life and just to enjoy the moment a little bit more. And I just feel like when I'm in those moments of adrenaline, I also just feel the most alive as well. That's what I get mostly from skiing, is just the adrenaline rush of just skiing, like whether I'm going as fast as I can or as big as I can, like you're just so in the moment and you just feel like you're just in a state of, it's meditation and adrenaline as well, because you're just thinking of nothing else but what you're doing at the moment. So I just really enjoy that.
How do you, like, do you have any people that you admire, like you're somehow idols or people you look up to, maybe not even hikers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, fortunately, some of them are hikers. I mean, definitely like Jimmy Chin is definitely one, is one name that I think of, who is so well-rounded and so talented in the work that he's done, and just a hard worker in general. He's doing all of these incredible, climbs, but with a camera in his hand. So for those of you that don't know, Jimmy Chin is a very, well-renowned, photographer, filmmaker, and climber and skier. He's based out of Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and he was the one who directed Free Solo that Alex Honnold did when he climbed El Capitan. So he's definitely one of those people who I look up to, just as far as like work ethic and just juggling. For him, he's juggling, you know, his time with his family and traveling on the road so much and all that stuff. So it seems like a cool lifestyle, but it's something that you really do have to work for. And make the right connections with. And then I'm trying to think of some other people who I definitely look up to. Like as far as skiers go, it's mostly, you know, people like Cody Townsend, who's someone who I've been following. He's trying to climb and ski the 50 classic ski descents of North America. So there's a book that explains that, but he's trying to be one of the first people to document and climb all 50. So that's like a YouTube channel and someone who I like follow very closely, like for the ski mountaineering aspect and to understand the process a little bit better, because I feel like with my perspective that I gained at 23, it's a lot different than when I was 13. So to be able to watch and observe that is very cool to watch and to just kind of take notes from. So those are just a couple of people, like Cody Townsend, Jimmy Chin. I could probably think of a few others at the moment, but I don't know. It's just anybody who just works hard to achieve their goal and just has like anyone who's just got like a work ethic is someone who just really inspires me. You know, and even last year, like working two jobs and 60 plus hours a week in order to save up for what I want, that's just like what I, you know, have learned to do. You know, it's something that you don't figure out right off the bat. You just kind of got to learn, like overcome and just understand that it's mind over matter, and you just have to simply just work through whatever your body allows you to do, and in your mind you just got to understand that it's only temporary and it's for the greater good in order to achieve what you really want to. So I don't know, I just admire those people who just work hard for what they want.
It's actually really inspiring to see what they do and the efforts they put in it.
Yeah.
Jordan, it's been almost an hour already that we've been talking. It's been nice. I've got three questions for you before we actually go. First question is, anyone who's actually into hiking, what would you tell him or her regarding like one of these seven highest mountains? How do you proceed?
So to anyone who is hoping to climb or who's hoping to get into climbing or get into who's hoping to, I guess, achieve like any goal that they feel so passionate about, just kind of understand and train your mind to understand that the hard work and the you got to understand that it, like the training and coordinating the logistics and everything is is typically not the most fun, because when you in mountain climbing, all you pretty much see is like the glory moments, you know, when you're standing on the summit and when you're on the side of the mountain, just, you know, living in the moment. Those are the moments that you see that make mountain climbing so appealing. But what you don't see is all the behind the scenes work. And so it takes a lot of research and a lot of focus to kind of keep yourself on track with being able to grasp all of the logistics and all of the training methods that you have to study and kind of learn from. And so that's when I say, like, going into all of this without a perfectionist mind state, I think is important. And to realize that there will be some points of failure and there will be some points of setbacks that you can, you know, adapt to and overcome. I'm doing a bad job explaining it, but what I'm trying to basically say is that, just, you know, there's going to be setbacks and failures, but it's just important to learn from those mistakes and just keep looking forward and keep, like, focused on the end goal. And also realize that there's only so much you can do within a day. And one of the hardest things I had to overcome was just not being so hard on myself and just realizing that there's only so much that I can do, like, every day, and just realize that this is also life that you're living. So make sure to, you know, also live every day like it's your last. And even as you're preparing for all these mountains, just enjoy the process along the way. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's just important to go out and make a memory every day to look back on. And in the grand scheme of things, the climb itself is just going to be another memory to look back on. And so just realize that it's a beautiful life that we live, and work hard to achieve those goals, but also enjoy every minute of it along the way.
Sounds good. How do we follow you, Jordan? Like, do you have any books, any social networks we can follow?
For sure. So my book, No Summit Out of Sight, is available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble. It's available in most bookstores. So that is, that's a way how you can kind of, get a full scoop of my story, top to bottom, or from beginning to end. And then, my Instagram, Gordy Bones, GORDYBONES, is my Instagram, username. So that's, typically what I'm most active on. So you can follow me on there, and, that's pretty much it. I also do, speaking engagements, and I travel around to schools to promote the book and to share my story as well. So, feel free to get in touch with me, either, on my Instagram or whatever it is, if anyone is interested. And, that's pretty much it, as far as my social platforms. And, yeah, get a hold of the book and, you know, get it as a gift for whoever you admire most. And, it's a good book for anyone who's also 13 years old and doesn't really know what they want to do in life. So it's a good play. It's a good book to, I'd say, just get inspired and to start pursuing your goals and what makes you most happy.
Definitely is. Jordan, last question. If you have the occasion tomorrow, with technology or whatever, to meet Jordan, who's 9 years old, what do you tell him?
That is a good question.
Better than that. The Jordan who's been walking 5 minutes his first hike, who's been struggling, like you said, what do you tell him just then?
I would go back to that same, don't be so hard on yourself, and just understand you gotta pick up your pants and just keep marching on. That's a good question. It's pretty much the exact same thing that I would say to anybody who's you know, who wants to get into climbing or who is pursuing what makes them happy, just I would say to my 9 year old self, just enjoy it a little bit more. And another thing I would tell my 9 year old self is keep a journal too. Just if there's one thing that I wish I did do, not only for the process of writing the book, because it would have been a lot easier to get the detail of my day-to-day life, but I would tell my nine-year-old self, just take a photo of yourself every day, or have some point of reference to, like, a memory, and also just start journaling. Just start writing about the process along the way. Just do a little paragraph entry every day, and just give your 23-year-old self a moment to look back and reflect on what you were feeling at the moment.
Sounds good. Jordan, I was really happy to meet you today and have an hour of dream to actually go all the way up. Thank you for sharing that, and I hope to see some further climbing in the time to come.
Absolutely. Thank you, Pierre. Much appreciated. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you as well.
It's my pleasure.
All right. Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers. If you liked the podcast, don't hesitate to share it with at least 2 people to continue spreading the word. And if you don't want to miss out the next episodes, don't forget to subscribe. See you soon.